This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Friday, Michael Jackson pleaded not guilty to charges of child molestation. Tomorrow, jury selection begins in the Martha Stewart trial in New York City. And later this week, Kobe Bryant will be back in court in Colorado as legal proceedings continue in his sexual assault trial. All three celebrities have teams of top-flight lawyers to handle the legal proceedings. And because money is no object, they've also hired public relations experts to handle damage control. Of course, that kind of PR is not just for celebrities. The beef industry hired consultants to help them survive the mad cow scare. Corporate scandals put Enron, WorldCom, and Tyco in the market for damage control specialists. And then there are some industries that don't need a crisis to have an image problem. Tobacco, pornography, and firearms, for example. Later in the program, documentary filmmaker Orlando Bagwell joins us to talk about his new film on the last years of the life of Martin Luther King Jr., Citizen King. But first, the purpose, the price, and the ethics of corporate and celebrity damage control. We want to hear from you. These PR campaigns are aimed at you, after all. You, the consumer, you, the potential juror, you, the public. Which of these campaigns do you think works, and why? And when something bad or embarrassing happened to you, how did you try to control the damage with your family, your friends, or your company? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Eric Desenhall, the president of Nichols Desenhall Communications Management Group, a crisis management firm here in Washington, D.C. He's the author of Nail'em, Confronting High-Profile Attacks on Celebrities and Businesses. And good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me.
When you're called in, what's your main goal as a damage control consultant?
To relieve pain. Our main goal is to make it go away. The objective of conventional public relations is to make people feel good about something. Mm-hmm. Public relations is often about telling pretty lies. Damage control is about telling ugly truths. And when you have a client in a terrible situation, there really is not a good chance that it will ever look good. Your objective is not necessarily to make it look good. Your objective is to make it go away.
Or at the very least, to make it look less bad.
Exactly, which is very difficult to send somebody an invoice and say to them, well, what you got for your money is you were attacked somewhat less than you would have been if you had hired me.
And let's make no bones about this. This is an expensive contract if you're calling in one of these consultants.
Absolutely. I'm in business. I am not, even though I write books, I am not an independent crusader. I am a hired gun who is called to make a problem go away.
And not speaking specifically for any client, or can you give us a ballpark figure of how much your services might cost per day?
I've never discussed that on the air. It's always a new one. I mean, I think most of us bill by the hour and bill very much like lawyers. And so you could have someone in our league for as little as $5,000 or $10,000 a month, or it can go up to hundreds of thousands of dollars a month if you're dealing with a hemorrhaging scandal.
Now, is there a set of rules that you apply when you're called in on a case? And I guess, of course, that varies as to who the customer is.
Well, I think that we are constrained by the law. We're constrained by ethics. There are certain things, if you look at history, where people have gotten in terrible trouble with their damage control campaigns by making things worse. I was reading on the internet last night something that I think takes the cake, a headline that says, I wrote it down here, Khmer Rouge leader admits mistakes. And I thought...
I'm sorry, it's not funny, but
believe me, I have a warped sense of humor, so I like that almost as much as when an airline went down years ago. The company described it not as a crash, but as the involuntary conversion of a 707. This type of nonsense is why the PR industry deservedly comes under attack, the notion that everything can be whitewashed. It is in the DNA of a lot of PR people to say everything is fine before we know that it's fine, which is why...
Deny.
Right. And sometimes there's a strategic reason for that. When you have a case where there are legal objectives that conflict with PR objectives, there is something to be said for being silent. The PR 101, I mean, I've done a lot of commentary on this Martha Stewart case, and people say, if she just came out and talked about it and apologized, everything would be great. Nothing could be further from the truth. I think that the greatest mythology is that apologies always work. House Speaker Livingston apologized, lost his job. Jimmy Swaggart apologized, lost his pulpit. Jim Baker apologized, lost his pulpit. Bill Clinton lied and left office with the highest approval ratings ever. So a lot of these cute little rules of damage control really don't work in a brutal street fight, especially in a case like Martha Stewart, where your lawyers say be quiet and your PR people say talk.
Isn't it interesting that we just had the case of Pete Rose, and who'd been hearing for years, if you just came out and publicly admitted it, everything would be fine, and he came out and publicly admitted it, sort of, and everything's certainly not fine.
No, it's not. I think that there are three elements to a personality-driven crisis that you have to take into consideration. Number one is the personality. Do we like you? And a lot of it is really no deeper than that. Do we like you? Number two, the act. Is this something we view as heinous, or is it something that's forgivable? Number three, what is the climate in which it's happening? In the case of somebody like Pete Rose, this is not a very cuddly personality. Gambling on your own sport is something that people view as fundamentally immoral, and we are in a current climate where there is tremendous hostility to people who are perceived to be getting away with something. Whereas in the 90s, O.J. could do what he did and get away with it, and so could Clinton, although the crimes were different. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I have never encountered a climate where the desire to see people pay a price for what they do is more intense.
Is it also a lesson in being sure as to who your PR people are representing? For example, you would think that the interests of his publisher, who's coming out with his new book, and his interests are not identical.
You are absolutely right. The publisher wants this to be as scandalous as possible, because as an author, I can tell you, that's how you move books. You say outrageous things. But if you are his minister or priest or rabbi, depending upon what church or synagogue he goes to, you want him to repent. But I argue with a lot of my friends in the media who are always saying, why don't these people just fess up? Well, the fess up school of thought is peddled by the media because a fess up provides them with an opportunity to see a nice on-air spectacle. It is not necessarily in the strategic best interest of the client, assuming what if the client's position is they didn't do it? So there goes the fess-up theory, and I fight about this constantly with friends of mine who love this notion that everybody should fess up. What if your position is I'm innocent?
So that causes quite a number of things. There's also any number of arguments that can be put if you're facing a legal case, and Martha Stewart, for example. There's a limited amount that she can say about the case. However, she's got this website that is presenting her side of the issue.
Well, first of all, Martha Stewart was not indicted for insider trading. She was indicted for the things she said after she was accused of it. Those are very different things. She was indicted for saying, I'm innocent, which caused people, the Justice Department, to say she's trying to fraudulently inflate the price of her stock. So if you were to say she should have just come out and apologized, she would have probably been indicted for insider trading, too. The benefit of the website is it is the only vehicle she has that can be edited by her attorneys, that she is in complete control of, to answer the questions that are on the table. Even though she has done some TV interviews, if you remember her first one with CBS, it was a disaster. Mm-hmm. She brought out a knife and was chopping cabbage and was very dismissive of the charges, and it really was a big problem for her.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Paul, who joins us from Denver, Colorado.
Hi. My question is, what is your opinion as to why the American public is so fascinated with watching celebrities fall? why do they spend so much time, watching all this stuff? Why don't they work on themselves?
Well, the answer is this. We define democracy in part as our right to tear you down. Witch hunts are an ancient part of the American culture, going back to the 1600s, where the accused witches were successful women. They were landowners. Ultimately, the people who were hanged and stoned were men and women who were more hangable or stonable. They were people without resources. But it goes back to the beginning of America that we like to see our haves twist in the wind and suffer. It's our way of saying you're no better than the rest of us. I've done a lot of celebrity cases, and what's amazing is the desire to see a celebrity fall is only equaled to the degree to which the celebrity sees themselves as being exempt from the basic rules of existence.
I was going to say there are occasional celebrities who may not have been involved in witch trials, but who did bet on their team in sports, and others who fired off a gun that that hit somebody in their driveway.
Absolutely. I mean, not some witch hunts. I mean, witch hunt implies that the charge is false, but plenty of these people who have been accused of things have really done them. In the case of celebrities, we have a mixed relationship with celebrity and royalty. On one hand, we want royalty, we want our celebrities, but on the other hand, we resent that they think they're better than us. And one of the biggest problems Martha Stewart has, and I'm not saying this to be cute, is she is in many ways a classic American witch, in the sense she is a woman who possesses wealth and power, who many people believe achieved success in some illegitimate way. And on one hand, we like this, the capitalist spirit. On the other hand, we resent it.
And Paul, just to be clear, we have been talking about some of these celebrity cases. We're also talking about some celebrity corporate cases,
right,
as well. And we're talking basically about the industry of public relations. But thanks very much for the phone call.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's get another caller on the air. And this is John, and he's with us from San Antonio.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'd like to take issue with your guest a little bit on the characterization of public relations people as telling convenient lies, trying to always paint a happy picture. In fact, what my experience is most public relations people work to do just the opposite, to get the executives of an industry that may normally want to do that, that their first reaction is to protect themselves, to actually go out and tell the truth and perhaps tell the story from the side of the company, but that doesn't mean painting lies. And I really think it's a really bad characterization of what public relations people do.
Just before we get an answer, John, what kind of companies do you represent?
Well, I work for the United States military in public affairs, which is public relations.
Okay, let's get an answer then from Eric Desenhall.
Well, I think that the point that I was trying to make is that in many cases, it is in the DNA of a lot of PR folks to assure people that they should remain calm, even when they shouldn't always remain calm. I mean, for example, when the anthrax scare happened several years ago, the PR people for the Postal Service came out and they said everything is fine. And 2 days later, two people died of anthrax poisoning. And I think that what I was trying to say is that while I am unrepentant about doing what I do for a living and unrepentant about defending the clients I defend, there are critics of the PR industry who are not altogether wrong about the tendency and the history of the industry in whitewashing certain things. It doesn't mean that it's absolute, but it's very difficult for me to say that virtually everyone, all of the critics of the PR industry are crazy. They are not. Occasionally they have a point.
John, do you ever have a hard time explaining to your clients in the military, essentially, that maybe openness is the best way?
Oh, absolutely. But in fact, that is the struggle. And I would say that the tendency in what's in the DNA is probably in the DNA of the executives, of the leadership of a company or in the military, to try to tell a story that's much more favorable to what they were thinking at the time. But a public relations person like me goes and tries to tell them that the best thing to do, strategically, the best thing to do is to tell the truth, but also the most ethical thing to do is to tell the truth. And in fact, if you do tell the truth ethically, in the end, you're going to come out a lot better because bad news doesn't get better with age. That's what we're constantly preaching, and it is extremely difficult.
John, good luck.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. John calling from San Antonio. When we come back from a break, we'll take more of your calls. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also email us. The address, totn@npr.org. Our guest is Eric Desenhall. We're talking about public relations and damage control. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Amid a raft of celebrity and corporate trials, we're talking about public relations and damage control. Our guest is Eric Dezenhall, president of Nicholas Dezenhall Communications Management Group, a crisis management firm here in Washington. Of course, you're invited to join us. Do PR campaigns influence the way you think about a person or a product or a company? Did you know when you're being spun? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's get a call in. This is David, who's with us from Honolulu.
Hi, thanks for having me, Neil.
Sure.
I have a question for your guest with regards to the type of clients or maybe business that he accepts. And he alluded to ethics being one of the criteria, I believe, earlier when serving clients or potential clients. I wonder how that comes into play personally. Has there ever been a client that your company has been unwilling to do damage control for as a result of personal feelings? Maybe someone's been charged with a heinous crime, someone in your company or you personally feel that they're guilty. Is that ever a factor, or is it simply a means of the individual or the company being able to afford the services, and it's implied that the services will be rendered?
We have turned away business frequently in the two decades we've been in business. I'll give you a few general examples without naming individual company names. I mean, number one, we don't do tobacco work. Most of our work is corporate, and we do a lot of healthcare-related work. And my mother died young of cancer. I do a lot of pro bono work for cancer issues. It's very difficult for me to run out into the countryside telling people how ridiculous it is to say that tobacco causes cancer when the reality is otherwise. I don't do tobacco work. Another example was we were contacted by an intermediary to represent a company in Europe, in the Balkans, actually, and it became clear to me when I started pressing them on who the client's backers were, that it was somebody who was most likely tied to organized crime. I don't really have any interest in doing that. I also turned away a client that heard that someone upstream had dumped dangerous chemicals into a river, and then they decided, well, what the heck, nobody will know the difference between their chemical waste and our chemical waste, so they dumped theirs. And then they wanted us to help make it look good. And I don't really have to work on stuff like that, and I don't want to. And those are the kind of things that that I walk away from. And some celebrity cases I don't like to take simply because it's too – one of the problems with celebrities is you really can't get through to them. It's just they're a different – their lives truly are different than ours. And sometimes if you have a client you can't get through to, it pays to walk away.
David, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Some would argue that if any profession needs positive PR, it's the public relations industry itself. Critics contend that PR can be misleading, manipulative, and self-serving. Joining us now from his home in Portage, Wisconsin, is Sheldon Rampton, editor of PR Watch, which is an online watchdog group. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Your website says PR Watch serves to, quote, combat manipulative and misleading PR practices. Some would say that all of PR is manipulative and misleading.
Well, actually, I wouldn't. I mean, there is some public relations that is perfectly innocuous and arguably even, you know, does a public service. The part that's harmful and manipulative just happens to be the part that I write about, and I've never run out of work. I mean, there are PR firms that specialize in representing clients that do reprehensible things, and Eric Dezenhall may personally have qualms about representing the tobacco industry, but in fact, the tobacco industry has been one of the major clients of public relations. In fact, the founder of the public relations industry, Edward Bernays, in the early 20th century, took on the tobacco industry as one of his very first clients. So the reality is that anyone who can afford to hire a skilled PR firm can afford to do so, and that's regardless of whether the client is a moral individual or a moral company.
Now, you've also said that public relations can be hard to recognize, that the best PR is invisible. What did you mean by that?
Well, one of the techniques that has been honed and refined for quite some time by public relations is what they call the third-party technique. The third-party technique consists of putting your client's message in someone else's mouth. A classic example, again, from the tobacco industry, was the work that Edward Bernays did in the early 20th century, where he got New York debutantes to march in the April 1929 Easter Day parade smoking cigarettes as a statement of rebellion against the norms of a male-dominated society. His client was the tobacco industry. The real purpose of that little demonstration was to get women to start smoking.
You could see the direct line right there to Virginia Slims.
Exactly. And so what they did was they put the client's message in the mouths of these seemingly independent suffragettes with a very different cause than the one that the client was really trying to push. And that's the way public relations can work invisibly. These days you have any number of examples of that, from scientists who give their opinions about everything from global warming to pesticides in foods, to the various friends and family members and character witnesses who come out whenever a celebrity is accused of some kind of misdeed.
Give us an example, if you would, of when a PR campaign, in terms of a crisis, a damage control kind of situation, which we're talking about here, when it's been effective, and give us an example of one that wasn't, in your opinion.
A PR campaign that's been effective, well, the tobacco industry, again, has been effective for 50 years at continuing to expand their markets, even though the evidence against their products was steadily mounting. If you wanted an example of a somewhat more ethical campaign, one of the examples that's frequently cited in the literature is Tylenol, that had a major product liability crisis when someone was tampering with their products and putting cyanide in their pills. And what they did was they pulled their product off the market and declared that they were going to redesign the packages so they were tamper-proof. And at the end of the day, they had a better reputation and more market share than before the crisis began, because they dealt with the issue assertively early on.
Yeah, we have an email exactly on that point from Betsy Reed in Henderson, Nevada. When I think about successful damage control, the best example, she writes, remains Tylenol after the product tampering case in the fall of 1982. At the time, I did not think the product would survive, but that situation was handled nearly perfectly, and it remains a very strong brand.
Yeah, another example from the celebrity side of things would be Hugh Grant, who got caught with a prostitute, and rather than take the advice of people who said he should be silent or kind of withdraw from public scrutiny for a while, he went around and did the talk show circuit and faced public scorn and humiliation in person and showed a certain amount of humility and humor about it. And at the end of the day, Hugh Grant's film career remained intact. So there is something that can be accomplished sometimes through these tactics of public atonement.
Eric Desenhall, things have changed a lot since the days of Fatty Arbuckle, when a similar kind of scandal ruined his career.
Well, you know, there's different variables involved. Not all clients are created equal. For example, one of the things I find is when a male client like Hugh Grant, even though he wasn't my client, is accused of being naughty, he's just a dude being a dude, whereas a woman who's accused of something is often viewed as unstable, crazy. And there is a double standard with representing male clients and women clients. And Hugh Grant went on to Jay Leno or Letterman, I forget which one, and was sort of acted like Hugh Grant, and he was largely forgiven. I think that when you have a case like Tylenol, which is often held out as the premier case, you need to keep in mind several things. Number one, there's two types of crises, character crises and sniper crises. A Tylenol was a sniper crisis where a crazy man poisoned the tablets. It's much easier to get out of a sniper crisis than it is a character crisis. And a character crisis would be something like Dow Corning breast implants or Firestone, where the allegation is your product is corrupt. You people are corrupt. So a lot of the cases I get, mostly are corporate, are of a character orientation that it's really difficult to get out of it, because the inherent quality and integrity of the management of the product is coming under fire.
Well, would you agree with that, Sheldon Rampton?
Yeah. Those are two different types of crises. And I guess what I would say to that, though, is that oftentimes the people who come under criticism over issues of character and the morality of the way they've done business or conducted their lives, oftentimes those people do deserve the criticisms that they're getting. And And the public relations industry as an industry doesn't really make a distinction between people who are unfairly accused and people who are fairly accused. They'll defend either one as long as there's money to do it, which essentially means that, you know, the celebrities are more open to public scrutiny because they're in the public eye. They also have more resources with which to defend themselves. You know, someone who's poor and anonymous, like Richard Jewell, who gets accused. Richard Jewell is the guy who
falsely accused in the Olympic Park bombing case in Atlanta.
Right, and even though he actually saved lives, he was crucified in the press, and he didn't have anyone to defend him like Eric Desenhall because he didn't have a lot of money. He couldn't afford to hire that kind of representation. So what the public relations industry does is it creates a structural advantage to people who can afford to hire high-priced public relations consultants.
Eric Desenhall, that seems to be unarguable.
It is unarguable. I think that while some of us, and I know we do pro bono work for people who come under fire and can't get resources, Sheldon's fundamentally correct that if you have money, you can hire help. That being said, I think that the spin doctor is seen as the American Merlin. He's homegrown folklore. He can spin your way out of anything. And one of the things that I'm skeptical of is the notion that you can spin anything. I think that you can often only spin a public that wants to be spun. And I think that in the case of celebrities and the powerful, when I look at who pays for my mortgage, it really is corporations. It is society's haves. That being said, we have such an intense market for attack right now that people like Kathy Lee Gifford, it went so far back in 1996 as for the Globe to set up her husband in a tryst in order to film it, and sales of the Globe newspaper went up 20% after that. So you not only have an infrastructure in place to defend the haves, you have an attack infrastructure in place to bring the powerful down, regardless of whether or not they deserve it or whether they don't. I mean, I think Kathy Lee Gifford may be sort of an obnoxious personality, but did it necessarily justify the expenditure of resources to set her husband up to prove that she's not as happy as she indicates that she is?
Sheldon Rampton, thanks very much for your time today.
Sure.
Sheldon Rampton is editor of PR Watch, an online public relations watchdog group, and he spoke with us from his home in Portage, Wisconsin. Here's an email from Patrick O'Neill. I just tuned in as a PR practitioner for 13 years. I think you need to understand PR people exist along a spectrum of very ethical to very unethical. There's nothing wrong with trying to get one's point of view through whatever means are available, as long as people and organizations don't lie about it. But the real question, he asks, is where is the media in all this? Trained journalists should be able to sort through facts and fiction to present real news and real information. Well, I guess part of the news media is paying to set up a tryst with Kathy Lee Gifford's husband.
Well, that is one element, although I don't think most media are engaged in that. The fact is that during the Lewinsky scandal, the very same public that said we're sick and tired of hearing about the blue dress was absolutely not telling the truth. I mean, the proof is in the media coverage that the very same people who say they hate scandal actively love it. And the fact is that the PR world works hand in hand with the news media and negotiates with them on an ongoing basis. I mean, when you see 60 Minutes sitting down somebody and crucifying them, the chances are there was a character like me trying to negotiate the ground rules to make the story less bad. If you remember the famous incident 10 years ago where Dateline NBC blew up a pickup truck in order to demonstrate that it was flammable, there were people like me on the scene who decided, you know what, we no longer can do business with them. We have to use PR resources for the purpose of embarrassing them and suing them versus trying to get the truth out because they stepped across the line. And more often than not, characters like me, whereas 20 years ago we might have been doing press releases to promote toothpaste, are brought in to deal with the very serious damage that is set in motion when the trial lawyers or when the news media seek to tear somebody down. And that's a less pretty side of our business.
We're speaking with Eric Desenhall, a damage control consultant. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is Paul Argenti, a professor of management and corporate communication at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. He's co-author of The Power of Corporate Communication. He's with us from Amsterdam, where he's traveling on business. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You consult with corporations and nonprofits on how to prevent crises. What do you advise them to do?
Well, The first thing, obviously, is try not to get into trouble in the first place. But there are also ways to plan for things that may happen to you. And I think most organizations that are aware of crises as a result of personal experience have tried to plan for them before they get into trouble.
For example, doing what?
Well, usually you can start off by having some kind of a brainstorming session where senior managers sit in a room and talk about what are the worst things that could possibly happen to us and develop ideas about those crises and try to really have someone facilitate the discussion about how outrageous it could be. And those are the kinds of things you need to be most worried about. Once you know what those things are, you can understand which constituencies that you operate with would be most affected by the crisis. And I think that makes for sort of better handling when something bad happens. Most of the people who are involved in crises have this through experience, but if you haven't had that through experience, you have to try to get it, you know, by trying to imagine that these things are happening. And you can decide which would be the right channel to communicate during that crisis, decide which teams would be best equipped to handle a situation like that, set up a plan that at least could take you through the scenario, you know, describe what kinds of things you would do. And that kind of leads into sort of handling the crisis better when it actually happens. A lot of this involves training and just good common sense.
Well, doesn't the reputation or credibility of the company or the individual before a crisis make a big difference?
It really does, and I think that's something to be aware of. I mean, if you have a good reputation to begin with and then you get into trouble, it doesn't matter whether it's sort of a sniper or a character crisis. I mean, you have high credibility in the bank. No matter what happens, people will at least at first give you the benefit of the doubt. And I think that's where some people have fallen. They have the credibility, and then something happens. They don't handle it well. So in the case of Tylenol, which you were talking about before, the company, you know, has good values to begin with, handled it beautifully, and all of it worked out very well.
Paul Argenti, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Paul Argenti, professor of management and corporate communication at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, co-author of The Power of Corporate Communications, and he was with us on the line from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. We just have a couple of seconds left, Eric Desenhall. Is it a good rule of thumb what he was talking about? You know, imagine what this is going to look like in the paper before you do it.
Oh, I think that that's right. I think that I would add that the best managed crises are the ones you never hear about because we made them go away. And it's there's a lot of things that never end up becoming public because there were quiet ways of making them go away. And some of that is planning. But I think that, to be honest with you, I've never been able to effectively plan for most of the crises in my own life. And I think that while planning is helpful, if given the choice between good planning and competent leadership is the way to go.
Eric Desenhall, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Desenhall is president of Nicholas Desenhall Communications Management Group. He joined us here in Studio 3A. He's the author of Nailum, Confronting High-Profile Attacks on Celebrities and Businesses.